Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Numbers 1-800-638-7781. If you're a first or second time home buyer looking for a house in Baltimore, the number is 1-800-638-7781, the Maryland Mortgage Program. We're joined in studio by David Simon, who's been on the show so many times in the last 19 years, I can't recall the number, actually. I should have looked it up, but didn't. creator of The Wire.
Well, I follow you. I mean, I started at that other radio station, and now I'm here. I don't go where you're not at.
I appreciate that, man. I deeply appreciate that. The Wire, Treme, 2010, it was named a MacArthur Fellow, of course, author of The Corner and much more, and The Corner that was on TV. And he's here to give a lecture Wednesday night, tomorrow night, at MICA. 7 p.m. at the Brown Center at Falvey Hall, and you can just walk on in and enjoy that. But welcome, David. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me back.
So what are you coming back to talk about?
I don't know, because it's an art school, and I have absolutely no training.
Well, someone had to assume you as a naturalistic author.
Yes.
That's what I read.
They're talking about American naturalism in filmmaking, right. Which I had to look up.
So did I, actually. What is that? Who was that? So I realized. You're Upton Sinclair, they're saying.
Well, I have no film training. I got into television through the back door, and it's a writer's medium, and I've managed to graft myself onto a lot of very smart visual people who taught me some things that, you know, I have a few set rules for how I do stuff, but I don't have any sensibility about I've never vocalized a lot about what I do in terms of film, in terms of the visuals. So now I'm in an art school. I have to cram. I have the last 48 hours have been like me pulling down you know this book and that book on film and trying to learn a couple of phrases here and there.
But it's in your head. I mean, you've directed episodes. You've gotten – how many years has it been now?
I've never directed.
Never directed one of your episodes?
No, I don't have a
really?
DGA card. I haven't even directed second unit. I stand behind the director, and if it's going bad, I start poking him in the ribs and say, that's not it. But you know, make it better is pretty much what I – don't do that. Do something else. No, I'm not a director.
So you've never directed – I didn't realize that. Until this moment, you've never
I have the last cut. I am
But you edit everything. You're part of that process.
Yes, I have the last cut. To the great frustration of many directors who will tell you that. But I'm at an art school tomorrow night, so I better put on my thinking cap.
And then in College Park after that.
Yeah, I'll do better there. That's just me pontificating about, you know, all sorts of crime stuff. And, you know, I can stay on point there. I'm really worried about the MICA gig, though, I have to admit.
You'd be fine. Unless there's nothing to worry about. The questions will come flowing. If you get stuck, just open the floor.
Somebody, that'll be it, right? I was talking to a director, and I told him I was laughing about this gig, and he said, "Just mention Truffaut and Hitchcock, and you'll be all right." So I looked him in the eye and said, "Who's Truffaut?"
And you were serious too, of course.
Well, I was kidding a little bit.
Yeah, but yeah. So. One of the things I was thinking about, there's always been so much. I was visiting some people in Southwest Baltimore the other night and doing a story there for one of our series called Soundbites, which is a story on the future of the food system. And so we're doing this stuff in Southwest Baltimore. And this is a critique they threw out. And they said, if David comes on your show next, I didn't know you, just before we said you were coming, did you have to ask him? I said, all right, what do you want me to ask him? And they said, when he did the story about our neighborhood, why did it feel like he didn't give us the story about the other side of our neighborhood, of people struggling to make it better, struggling to fight the crime, trying to make a solid neighborhood? It felt like it wasn't there.
Did they not follow the main character of Ella Thompson, who was one of the five main points of view in the book? I mean, who endeavored in that Franklin Square area? Who gave more of herself to making that? There were other people. There were other committed people. She wasn't alone, but she definitely represented a population group that had fundamental point of view in that narrative. I'm sort of shocked to hear that.
That was it. Was an interesting point they brought up, and I was doing a different story completely, and it just came out because we were right. Yeah. It's right in the center of where you.
Yeah, I think what they meant to say, I don't mean to put words in their mouth, but what they probably said is, why didn't that point of view prevail over all the problems? Is that what they meant?
Maybe because that's what they meant.
If that's what they meant, because we were not writing a, we were not raising any false hopes for what the problems were and how the problems were being addressed. The coroner was talking about a drug saturated neighborhood and a drug war that wasn't working. And that was the, you know, to the extent that anything we did was accurately predictive, I would say that book, Ed and I, you know, we got some stuff right. You know, looking back on it, that was 1993. Looking back on it from 17 years later, the drug war was not resolved in any way that made made sense. It continued to be a destructive force. The drugs were a destructive force, but the war against them was profoundly destructive. West Baltimore and Southwest Baltimore have to this day. I was just out in West Baltimore yesterday. It's the same. The only thing that's different is there are now vast tracts of vacant lots.
Right.
You know, they've destroyed the village in order to save it. And, you know, to an extent, some of it's gone. But what remains has the same attendant problems. So what story would they have me have done that would be the truth?
So what is – when you go back now and you think about – well, you still live in Baltimore, even though you're shooting what you're shooting in New Orleans – how has it progressed or changed for you? I mean, your analysis about what this society, especially what capitalism has done to our culture, has done to people in the society, dislocation, deindustrialization, throwing people out of work, destroying families. I mean, how do you, as you reflect on it now, how do you see things where we at this moment in this part of the new century?
Oh, God. Yeah. This is the kind of questions I get now that, you know, this is it's really funny because when I actually was reporting and I had notepads full of facts and figures, nobody wanted my opinion. And now that I make television shows, like people ask me like big questions like that. The Wire was a very aggressive critique of capitalism run amok, of unrestrained free market capitalism. Which is not to say that I sit here with, you know, a copy of Das Kapital in my back pocket and wait for the revolution. You know, I'm not a Marxist. I understand without any naivete that capital and capitalism are the only ways to generate mass wealth in the modern world at this point. You know, the 20th century decided that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an inevitability to it. But I think we've mistaken capitalism for more than what it is. It's an incredible economic engine to generate wealth. It's not a blueprint for how to construct a just or viable society. And we've mistaken one for the other. We've taken what is an economic force and lent it all kinds of credibility for problem solving and for civic building and for social justice that it's completely indifferent to. In fact, you know, if you leave it alone and you don't regulate it, it's completely indifferent to building long-term economic growth. It'll build short-term profit.
Right.
Wall Street taught us that.
Right.
So if you looked at what The Wire was, it was an argument about, you know, I mean, to make it simple, we're all in this together. You know, America, either you're building two Americas, that of the haves and the have-nots.
Which we are, it feels like.
You're eviscerating the middle class, and people
right.
are either slipping below the waves or they're being minted as new millionaires. Both things are true. But either you're going to build two Americas, and they're going to become increasingly at odds, and it's all going to be about gated communities and geography and who can have health insurance and who can get sicker. And who can have a job and who can be marginalized. I mean, we don't need a portion of our population that is growing. And that's, you know, that's, it's, there's, we're, America's going to become a very dark and brutal place if we don't really take a hard look at what we're doing here. so I look at that and I say, you know, when we started The Wire, we were looking at stuff like Enron and the Catholic Church, these outliers of what was coming,
right.
You know, of calling crap gold. And I'm only saying crap because it's the radio, calling crap gold and then selling it as gold and until somebody gets wise. I didn't think, you know, we weren't that bright. We didn't think, we thought there were some bad companies out there and that, you know, there was a problem with regulation. And there was, you know, we were looking at institutional failures and sort of the CYA logic of you know, the Catholic Church scandals were going on at the time. So there's an institutional thing framed over it. But we didn't think for a minute that that the entire world economy was being, you know, was being sort of heaved onto the pile by a couple guys in the back room who were saying, see these mortgage-based securities? They're really worth a lot, and you should invest. When, in fact, they were worth nothing.
Right.
And that they would get whole financial institutions to buy into it. You know?
They did. I mean, it's
inspiring. I mean, how much damage these guys did,
and still wreaking it in many ways across the globe.
Oh, of course,
Greece, Europe, Africa, all over the place.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I had a very wealthy man who I know said to me after the crisis, he said we're talking about. He said, "Well, I went to England to visit some of my partners in the business, and they said, crying to me, 'We've lost half our wealth. We lost half our wealth.'" And he said to them, "No, you didn't lose a thing, because it was all an illusion. We never had it to begin with."
That's right.
That was the reason.
That's the reason to create these monetized versions of nothing, which is the actual companies, the actual value of actual companies had been invested to the fullest possible extent. What was of value in the world of capital had been bought, but the problem was there's all this other money, and they needed to invent something for the money to go somewhere. There was, you know, as the developing world comes along, there's Chinese money. There's,
right.
You know, somebody needs to get hold of that money and invest it in something. And the only thing they didn't mention was that they were now selling things that were worth nothing just because they needed something to sell. And again, you know, the short term is if somebody can make a short term profit off of it in the same way that if some bureaucrat can get a promotion by saying crime's going down or school test scores are going up, institutionally we'll do that. You know, buy this right now, and the share price will go up, and I'm not going to worry about it for right now.
And they don't.
Hopefully I'm not left holding the bag. Hopefully it's somebody else.
This is moving in a different direction. We have these calls coming in at 410-319-8888. Come to your calls in just a second as we talk with David Simon. Of course, The Corner, Homicide, Wire, now Treme. I was watching the Academy Awards for like 5 seconds the other night and spent too much time looking at it. Just
5 seconds more than me. What happened? You'll have to tell me later.
Not much. And I was thinking about Idris Elba, who was one of the guys in The Wire, brilliant actor from Britain, said he's not bothered with it. It's not for us, is what he said. The Academy Awards, not for black folks.
Oh.
Not for us, right? I thought about that. We talked about it the other day on the show, and we did kind of a post-mortem on the Oscars. It was just more about talking about where the industry is and what happens, what people see and how they see it and what they don't see. And how Idris, in many ways, was right about what he said. Not in many ways, he was right. But it was also the same thing that happens to things like The Wire and other things that you've done. Because the bodies of work that they don't even want to look at, they don't want to think about.
Well,
you know, I mean,
yeah, The Wire stuck around in a way that nobody anticipated. I mean, somebody just sent me some paperwork that showed the DVD sales for the last quarter. In the last quarter, The Wire moved about 300,000 units. I'm speaking like a capitalist. and by the way, I don't really have a piece of that. That's just, but that's why HBO allows me to make TV shows that nobody watches on Sunday night, because they have a long tail. But that rate of sale is larger than it's ever been. The Wire is now selling more.
Oh yeah!
Now in 2012, we've been off the air for 4 years. That was totally unanticipated. Nobody had a plan. If they tell you there was a plan, they're lying, because nobody. When we started, DVD sales of box sets of TV were almost non-existent. And what's happened is television has been allowed to become idiosyncratic, maybe in the case of The Wire, racially idiosyncratic, but also its point of view and its you know, its sort of political dissent, it's able to exist because it didn't need numbers to immediately to succeed. HBO wasn't operating on that logic, so they sort of left it alone. They left us alone in the corner to play our little games and make up our stories. And you know, 4 or 5 years after we finished, it's selling. So you know, it's like there's something about that that like you know, who knew that word of mouth actually still worked?
And, well, you know, it long after Wire was over, about a year after, we got calls from people from British newspapers to interview us about The Wire because we had done so many shows about The Wire, and that the mayor of Reykjavik, you know about this, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Demands that everybody in his cabinet
watch
The Wire. He won't hire them.
Mark,
Reykjavik.
This is so weird. I'm selling more books now of Homicide in the Corner, the books, the nonfiction books, than I ever did before. I just happen to be selling them in Germany and in Spain and in Italy and in the UK. Apparently, American dystopia plays really well the further you get away from America. I mean, I can't get, you know, I'm shaking my head at it too, I have to say.
I mean, you do tackle the dystopian, for want of a better word, vision of who we are, where we're going. But when I watched Tremé now, and I had a long talk with one of your good friends and actors, also a good friend of mine, Clark Peters, who's been in both The Wire and we talked a lot about the difference between Tremé and The Wire and what it's like to act in those two places. Because it really, in other words, the dystopian vision of what happened in Baltimore that was portrayed in The Wire, whether it was the docks or the inner city or the school system or whatever it was, City Hall that you were looking at. In Tremé, we were talking about this, it's like you're also saying, though, this is like a line being drawn where people are protecting their culture.
That's right.
Fighting to protect their culture.
Clark gave you that?
No, I gave it to Clark. He agreed with
it. Oh, okay. Well, you guys understand the show. And by the way, that puts you in a minority. But that's absolutely right. I mean, we're portraying a city that is just as dysfunctional, and in fact more so because of the storm, because of what Katrina did, than Baltimore, New Orleans. And yet, that city has come back on terms that New Orleanians would recognize as being meaningful and in ways that matter to New Orleanians, primarily, you know, not because of any political leadership that was absent, not because the money was used in any intelligent way, because the money, you know, the money that was thrown at the problem after Katrina was, you know, disaster capitalism is its own brand of mayhem. And you know, Naomi Klein had
brilliant.
That one right.
She's brilliant.
She is brilliant. And New Orleans is a primary example. I mean, there was no impetus from all the institutional forces in society. What brought that city back was people refused to get up in the morning and live in Houston or Oklahoma City or Memphis or anywhere else. You know, before the storm, 77% of New Orleanians were born there. That's an unbelievably high figure.
Wow.
For a country that has become very transient. But New Orleans is its own. You know, it's America, but not really. And it's the best part of America in that it has resisted giving up its past in some remarkable ways. Everything is rooted in the past in New Orleans. The past is always present. And they've fought. I mean, they brought back that city by means of culture. That was the only thing that worked. And so they leaned on it so hard. And that's, you know, the one thing that got lost when we were doing The Wire, and I never meant it to get lost, and to me it didn't. I mean, I had such affection for Baltimore. I still live here. I mean, I had affection for Baltimore. It was always implied to me that the city was worth saving.
Right.
When we were doing, you know, and then as we did The Wire, I started reading these very callow reviews by people, usually from out of state, usually not Americans. I'm sorry, usually Americans, but not, you know, not familiar with Baltimore, not people overseas. They weren't that callow. But, you know, you'd read some review by somebody in New York. Why don't they just move? Why don't they get, if Baltimore is that much of a hellhole? I'm like, that's not the point. That's not what we're saying. And, you know, we're saying that certainly West Baltimore has profound problems. East Baltimore has profound problems. Lower Park Heights, you know, I mean, we were talking about areas that have been completely divorced from the American economic model. But we weren't implying that Baltimore not only didn't have a right to exist, but shouldn't exist and shouldn't thrive. I mean, you know, it was written by Baltimoreans as Baltimoreans, and it shocked me that people looked upon The Wire as being almost an argument against the city. And so, in some ways, Katrina and Tremé allowed us to very overtly, because culture is out there in the street. It's so visual. It's right. So, you know, what New Orleanians do is an everyday thing, and it's in the street in terms of the music and the dance and the culture. Because of that, it allowed us to make the argument for the city and for the idea of urbanity and American urbanity and the melting pot. Because nothing is more melting pot than New Orleans. Nothing.
It's an amazing city.
Yeah.
And there's some deep connections that are strange between Baltimore and New Orleans.
McDonough School. Do you know that one?
Yeah. Go ahead. Tell the story.
Oh, I can't figure it out. Maybe somebody can call in and explain it to me. The guy who founded McDonough School here in Baltimore also founded the McDonough Schools in New Orleans.
Right.
In New Orleans, they were used to educate freed black and actually, I think in time of slavery, actually kids who had been slaves or were manumitted, but it was for public and they're public
right.
schools, and it was for impoverished kids, and particularly African American kids. In Baltimore, it became one of the premier private schools.
It's a military school for all boys.
Yeah. It's the same man's will. He had interests in both cities. In Baltimore, it became one thing. In New Orleans, the opposite. How did that happen?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I want to know.
I want to know that too. That's a good question.
I think somebody in Baltimore did something wrong.
By the way, we're live here tonight with David Simon. 410-319-8888. Those of you who called in and didn't get in, call back and we'll get right to your calls. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to the Facebook page and look there and see if you've written there. Get your thoughts there. It's either Mark Steiner or Mark Steiner Show, and go there and we'll get you on there no matter which one you're logged on to, whichever one it is, just go there. 410-319-8888. But Baltimore, New Orleans were the center of black Catholicism.
That's right.
We had a man on the show whose name I'm blocking on a minute, but it'll come to me, who was a historian in the city, who did all this research, that the lines that happened in New Orleans used to happen in Baltimore at funerals.
Did they really?
Yes. He has all these pictures and has these songs that came out of them. It was an amazing evening with him. And also, downtown Baltimore, where right before we get to the Inner Harbor, if you remember, I was a kid growing up, it was called Frenchtown. And it was called Frenchtown because when the Cajuns fled Canada from the Brits, they came here first. Stayed here for a while.
We couldn't hold on to them?
And they went to New Orleans.
We'd have a cuisine.
Beyond crab cakes.
Yeah, that's right. Beyond crab cakes. We'd have our own cuisine. And we'd be able to carry a tune if we'd have kept that tradition up. There are very similar, you know. And the problems inherent in terms of poverty, in terms of, you know, tracking what's happened to the port cities in both places— very similar. There's a very similar dynamic between the two cities. I don't feel as if when I'm reading the Times-Picayune, I don't feel as if I'm not experiencing, you know, some recent history in Baltimore as well.
It's a different paper too. We've had some of those guys on the show from Times-Picayune. Yeah. The columnists are writing about New Orleans.
Yeah.
We're here with David Simon, of course, creator of The Wire and Tremé, The Corner. Wrote Homicide. Then he wrote The Corner. 2010 MacArthur Fellow?
I don't remember.
What do you? You got the MacArthur.
It's whenever it happened. That's when people started teasing me about it. So,
the Genius Award.
Yeah, you don't do anything wrong at home without that being brought up.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
Okay, genius.
Exactly right. Exactly right. That one lands with a thud. Believe me.
So we'll take a short break and come right back with David Simon. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Come right to that call when we come back. 410-319-8888. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're here with David Simon, of course, The Wire, Tremé, Homicide, The Corner. Two of those things, The Corner and and Homicide were books that he'd written based on his work as a reporter for The Sun that he did for many years. He's here with us in the studio. He's back in Baltimore. He lives in Baltimore, but he's in New Orleans shooting Treme, here to speak tomorrow night at MICA, 7 p.m. at the Brown Center, Falvey Hall, 1301 West Mount Royal Street. You can just go and show up and go in.
I guess we'll, so.
I think you can.
Okay.
I hope I'm telling the truth. And we'll get the College Park information in a minute, which is Friday night?
Thursday night.
We'll be in College Park. We'll get the information to you before the end of the hour as well.
I'm only doing the College Park gig because I looked at the fee, and it's a way of getting all the money I paid in parking tickets when I went there.
You?
Back in one.
Parking tickets there.
Everyone did. Carl Bernstein doesn't have a degree because he couldn't pay all his parking tickets in the university. It's true. So I am. I have totaled up all the parking tickets I got. I'm getting them all back on Thursday night. That's why I took that gig.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Would you have your diploma?
Oh, yeah, I got that.
410.
Whatever.
And you worked on the paper, didn't you?
I did. That was actually the education that I got that mattered. I worked on the Diamondback.
You and Aleska. 410-319-8888. Julie, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Julie. Welcome.
Hi. I think I've told you this before, Mark. I'm a very proud Baltimorean, and my parents are part of the hippies that saved the Southeast Baltimore in the 70s. And David's work doesn't make me horrified. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy.
Well, that's because you're not right. You'll do fine in this town.
There's a rough warmth to the Baltimore people that's kind of like the itchy wool blanket. It's warm, but it's not cozy. And I just couldn't imagine living anyplace else other than with people from Baltimore. And David's work is always made, like I said, I look out the window to see if the kids are running down past my street when he's...
You know, I feel the same way. You know, I'm spending a lot of time in New Orleans for this show, and I do love New Orleans, and it's hard not to love it. But come into town, turn the key, walk back into your row house. There's something about it. Just feels very familiar. Is not the right term. It's more than familiar. It feels correct. And I can't figure out why. But maybe if I ever did figure out why, it would ruin it.
Julie, you still there?
I said my husband has traveled all over the country, and he says he loves Baltimoreans best. You there?
Yes, yeah. We're here. Go ahead.
And I had a friend who lives in Texas and Alaska, and she said Alaska's pretty wonderful, but it's still not Baltimore.
Alaska's not Baltimore for sure.
Yeah.
They've got.
Right, I'm going to hang up now. All right, bye.
Take care. I mean, when you talk about Baltimore, I think about everybody from Schaefer to Du Burns and millions of people I could think of who aren't in politics. In some ways, Baltimore does create quirky characters in ways that a lot of other cities I've been to don't.
Yeah, I think in some ways, because our media market isn't that big, you can be peculiar and still have a successful career, successful political career. You can be idiosyncratic, and you don't get devoured in the way that maybe New York, you know, everything gets shaped into either Gotham or L.A. in this country, sort of culturally.
right.
And there's something about Baltimore that I've tried to figure it out. It's the reason that the Wire appeals is because other people could recognize their cities in it. It wasn't that Baltimore was so idiosyncratic that this is this weird place and I got to go there. I mean, if you lived outside of St. Louis or in St. Louis or Cleveland or any of the American Rust Belt second tier cities, of which there are many,
many, many,
it made sense immediately to you. What I can't figure out is why Europe went crazy for it. That, you know, it's like, you know, why do people in Cologne think it speaks to them? That part I haven't figured out, and I keep asking them when I run into them, and they speak another language, so I can't really figure it out. But but Baltimore, it makes sense that we weren't telling one city's story. But at the same time, you can tell the story with some degree of idiosyncrasy and it feels real because you're latching onto things that are unique and sort of worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't explain how much gravitas it gave when, you know, every three or four episodes somebody would, you know, put a knife into the crevice of a blue crab and crack it open. Meanwhile, while they're discussing politics or whatever, you know, you would see, and you know, or Bunk would pick up the crab guts and eat them the right way.
Right.
That was, you know.
And he's not from Baltimore.
No, but he's from New Orleans.
He's done remarkable stuff in New Orleans.
He has.
We chat every once in a while. He's done remarkable stuff in the community he was in, rebuilding that community. I mean, he's like committed to doing that.
Yeah, he's trying to work to rebuild Pontchartrain Park, which is where he grew up, which is one of the first African American middle class communities in America, and it was completely wiped out by Katrina, and he has committed himself to dealing with that. He also has been trying to get a grocery store, a good grocery store, up in the Lower Ninth Ward, which doesn't have a decent grocery.
Wow.
And you want to talk about hitting your head against the wall, you know, with vested interests. And, I mean, in some ways it makes Baltimore seem almost functional to hear what he's going through in New Orleans.
No, it's here. I mean, we're doing a series now on food deserts. There are communities in Baltimore, too many, tens of thousands of people who have no access to decent food in this city.
Sure.
Unless they take a bus. I mean, I talked to people the other day who I saw walking across the street. I didn't have my microphone, but next time I will. Who were walking across from the light rail to Wegmans in Hunt Valley.
Yeah.
And we just started talking. So I just bumped into this, and they were saying that they lived in they lived near Sandtown.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taking the light rail to Wegmans.
To get good produce.
Just be able to buy good produce.
Good meat.
Back home. And had to schlep the bags from one place to the other.
And it's been that way since, you know, forever. Listen, we've been building two Americas, geographically, economically, politically, socially. And it always amazes me when we express surprise at the outcome, since we've made this effort across the board, and we've done so for 50, 60 years. You know, it goes back to the New Deal. I mean, it goes back to housing patterns that were established in the New Deal in terms of government-backed mortgages and where you would redline and where you would sell to an African-American family. That goes back to the 30s and to a Democratic liberal administration. You would think watching the Republicans, you know, scream and yell like pygmies, you know, from another planet in this election, that there was a substantial difference between the political parties. But I wonder, no political party has ever, neither one of them has ever addressed themselves to the fact that we're a culture that can't figure out how to be a comprehensive, all-inclusive society. You know, we're constantly throwing people out of the boat. And so that's going on in New Orleans right now, and it's going on in Baltimore.
Right.
And I just drove through West Baltimore yesterday for about 5-6 hours. And I'm looking at all this real estate that's now vacant because nobody could figure out how to basically solve and make it part of America again. You know, they've destroyed the village in order to save it. You know, block after block of vacant lots of brownfields, and the same thing with Hopkins on the east side. You know,
right,
it's just incredible.
There are both creative solutions and solutions that'll work. We did a town meeting that will be on the air tomorrow night, where we were raising those issues. But
do they want them to work? Is there any impetus?
The power?
Well, do enough of us want them to work? Does enough of America want? You know, what America seems to want is a gated community and a private police force. You know, at least the money does.
The money does.
The people with the money. Yeah. I mean, the money is routing itself away from whole classes and whole tracts of people.
But the money's not all of us.
Money speaks pretty loudly. By the way, I've been informed that money is speech and that it buys a lot of talk. It certainly buys a big megaphone.
Right.
And it's demanding to be left alone and to be concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people.
And so, there are people in the country trying to overturn Citizens United. That's a whole move to get states to begin to do that.
I feel a lot better about Roger Taney and his statue being down there on Mount Vernon because, you know, him and his Dred Scott decision, it's not the most shameful thing anymore. You know, it's at least been equaled because I'm not kidding. Citizens United, you know, it's not just that corporations are people. That's the one that everyone seized on. It's that money is speech.
Right.
That's a decision that is perverted on about you know, on a couple of really profound levels. And it is the Dred Scott decision of our generation. And, you know, if you look at, like, well, is reform possible and do the elections matter and, you know, can we elect the right guy? I don't believe in it anymore. You know, I mean, people ask me, well, what can you do? After Citizens United, my answer is with increasing sincerity is, well, you know, somebody's going to pick up a brick. You can do that because I no longer believe in the process. I mean, they've purchased the process.
They have purchased the process. I mean, look at what's happening now with the super PACs and all the election.
Is the Supreme Court looking at what they've made an American election into, and are they ashamed? Are they capable of shame? Because this kind of electoral process, even if I'm a Republican, you know, watching what's happened to anybody who's come up against Romney in any of the early primaries and seen what's been leveled, and now it's coming back on Romney because the money's going full circle. You're looking at it, you're saying, my God, this is how we're going to find our best people and elect them? The Republic can't stand.
Well, I think the Supreme Court knew exactly what it was doing. I mean, there's a new book out that would be.
You're more cynical than I am. I like it. I like it.
There's a new book out by this guy, Clements. Corporations are not people. He tells a whole history in this book, and we're going to have him on the show. Part of what he talks about is how the man who became Justice Lewis Powell, before he became Justice Lewis Powell, was Lewis Powell, the attorney for all the corporations, made all these deals with the Chamber of Commerce, began the fight for corporations as people, money as speech, back in the early 70s before he was appointed, and kind of led the way. This has been going on for the last 40 years, people fighting to make this change because they were terrified of the change that was coming in their face. They were terrified of the demographic change that made America not just a white man's land anymore. They were terrified of all that change, and they wanted to stop it. And that's where we are.
Well, and you're really seeing and sensing a lot of the anger over that sort of transformation. I mean, you know, fast forward 30, 40 years, and it will be a white plurality in this country, not a white majority. And you know, I think you're seeing a certain anger on the part of some people. I mean, listen, we've become a much healthier country when it comes to race. We've elected, you know, a person of color, which I didn't think I'd see in my lifetime. We've become healthier on this overall. And yet the reaction from some minority of the country to the inevitability of this, I think, has become really visceral and really passionate. And you're seeing it in our election process.
And you play with that in your work. I mean, you play with that. I think about the guys who are trying to control New Orleans in Treme, the guy who runs the construction, those guys on top. That's them.
Let's be blunt. There were people who wanted to build a different New Orleans.
They wanted black folks out.
And they wanted, less poor people, less poor people.
Less poor people.
And they thought, there's a whole bunch of talk, if we get rid of the projects, we'll get rid of crime. They got rid of the projects, crime came back, as healthy as ever. The crime rate was as bad as ever, but they got rid of all the public housing. Now, nobody remembers that, but public housing, all that stuff was built for white people. It was built for returning veterans in the 40s.
Right.
When public housing was for white people, there was no hue and cry against building it, where you built it. You know, it was only when it became segregated, you know, by virtue of housing patterns to African Americans, and by virtue of economic status to African Americans, that the whole notion of public housing became an affront to people. It's very cynical. And you look at New Orleans, people were living on Air Force bases. They were living in motels on the side of the road, you know, out in Arkansas and Oklahoma City and Texas. And they couldn't get home. And they were knocking down the housing projects.
As you point out in Treme, some of those housing projects were in fine shape. There was
the Lafitte were totally, you know, but they made New Orleans a little more white, or a lot more white, and they made it harder for some people to get home. And ultimately, they took Louisiana, which was a purple state in terms of national politics, and they pushed it that much further into the red. And you can't convince me that wasn't the Bush administration reading their Naomi Klein and saying, don't waste a disaster, use it.
Right.
Because they basically transformed a state that was purple and they took away some of the blue, and that state is far more red than it was before the storm.
So there is power in the creative mind. There's power in the creative eye. There's power in the creative hand. I mean, you and others who are doing what you do, which is putting things out there, like the movie that, of course, the Academy Awards would never put out, like Pariah, which is a very powerful, wonderful, beautiful film, I think.
Yeah.
There's power in that creative work that can make people think and wrestle with it, which is one of the reasons that
it's very kind of you to think so. But I don't think
you don't think so.
I don't think I've had. Yeah, I mean, listen. What's the one argument that we've put forward aggressively in The Wire and in the aftermath of The Wire, which was the drug war is a fraud. It's a war on the underclass.
Right.
It's not helping us. If it was draconian and it worked, but we've become the jailingest country on the planet by totalitarian states, you know, Russia, China. Nobody jails more people than we do, and for less cause. You know, the prison population is less violent than it's ever been in our history by percentage, and yet we've had absolutely no impact with that message. Part of the problem of working in TV is that you're trying to say something, you're trying to make an argument, you're very political, you're thinking this will be relevant to people. But what people are seeing is they're seeing an entertainment, and they want them some more Omar, and they like it when somebody gets killed, and they like it when somebody sleeps with somebody else. And, you know, getting past the idea of are you entertaining me in the realm of television is very hard. But it's hard for journalists too, you know. I mean, where's the outrage anymore? I worry about that.
Well, I think there's a lot of outrage in America. As a matter of fact, I keep ignoring my...
Well, there is in this room, you and me.
And it's out there, too. 410-319-8888. I apologize for not getting you all in the air. 410-319-8888. David Simon is in the house here. We have another 10, 15 minutes to go, and David's here. Of course, he wrote Homicide, wrote The Corner, made those two into TV, as well as Wire and Treme. 410-319-8888 is the number. And you can join us here. We'll get you in. He'll be here tomorrow night. You can meet him tomorrow night at MICA, 7 p.m. at the Brown Center, Falvey Hall, 1301 West Mount Royal Avenue. And for those of you listening and live down in Montgomery County and Prince George's County, he will be Thursday night at the Gildenhorn Recital Hall at the University of Maryland College Park. And that's at 5:30 Thursday night, March the 1st. My producer found it. Thank you, Christina. 410. I couldn't live without good producers. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So, I mean, that's interesting what you say. I mean, I think that a lot of people, though, I think the opposite of that. I think that what you and others do does have an effect. You can't not watch and think. It's not just about the entertainment. And the entertainment is there to pull you in.
I don't know. It would be very gratifying to think that anybody's mind got a little bit changed by anything we've done in a good way. But I have a feeling that people are less inclined to... I mean, part of the critique of The Wire is of a culture that no longer can address the real substance of its problems or even recognize its problems, much less address them. And I think that's more the culture that I'm living in. Politically and socially than not. I don't mean to induce any kind of sense of lethargy, because I don't believe that. I think, you know, I have a great quote that I always use from Camus, and I always butcher it. I always tell myself I'm going to memorize the quote, and then I don't. But he basically, in Resistance, Rebellion, and Death, or Myth of Sisyphus, was the essay, he said that to commit to a cause with no possible chance of success is absurd, but to not commit to a worthy cause, a meaningful cause, because of you have no chance of success is equally absurd, and only one choice gives you the slightest possibility of dignity, and dignity matters. And so, you know, to quote somebody else, I.F. Stone said the fights that you have where you know you're going to lose are the ones worth having.
Right.
But you know, I don't see the country going in the right direction, and I don't see it. I don't see people of reason getting hold of the process. I see money, you know, getting hold of the process, and you know, our political process has been so purchased now that I don't see the ability of ordinary people to reform anything.
Except maybe I think some of this stuff is happening outside of that process. That's where it's happening. It's not inside.
Well,
anymore.
I admire the impulse behind the Occupy stuff, but what's clear is they don't have a second act. You know,
But to me, There's a magazine that we partner with in doing stories called Yes Magazine.
Uh-huh. I don't
know if you know it or not. But one of the things they do in Yes Magazine, which I love so much in the interviews we do, is people all across the country who are kind of just, it's not just standing up, but they are creating things despite that and around it, outside of it. A lot of people are saying that until you build something outside that's powerful, you're never going to be able to attack that thing. The only thing that's going to change is systemic. The only way you're going to do it is by building something separate from it and then attacking the citadel. Because, you know, I mean, you can't...
Well, it certainly makes your life meaningful while you're doing that. And you do more good than harm and thereby acquire meaning. But outside of that, you're saying outside of the huge apparatus that capital has created to subvert popular will. I mean, just take the idea of militarism and our wars. You know, I mean, you can stand up and you can object to the saber rattling over Iran now following the last two wars in the Middle East, and you can argue against it. And you can be passionate. You can think that creating an anti-war dynamic, a populist anti-war dynamic, is going to have some impact. But they've been a little busy privatizing our military response to the point where, first of all, it's a draft. There will never be another draft in America. They figured
right.
that out. They, you know, as long as people aren't being drafted, they've pretty much figured out they can fight an unpopular war for decades at a time. And at the point at which people start to get weary and start to say, can we please bring the boys home? Yeah, we can, but we're going to leave over these corporations that are going to fight the war privately.
Right.
You know, every single Marine, not every single, but, you know, of the 20-something Marines in that unit that we depicted for Generation Kill, I would say 18, 19 of them are working as contractors and making 5-6 times what they made as U.S. Marines, and they're still over in Iraq. And Afghanistan fighting the war. They're fighting it as contractors, you know, with the CIA and everyone else. And we've privatized our militaristic impulse.
We have.
So, you know, you can stand up and say, I'm against the war. But they've marginalized that. They've marginalized the passion of individuals to say what's right and wrong.
I think... You can't stop them from starting this war if they want to start a war with Iran. You can't stop Israel from dropping the bombs if they're going to drop the bombs. But that's what I'm saying. I think those kind of things you're happening now are outside of the realm. It's going to push people to in a different direction in their opposition to what's happening. Or they'll just become comatose with TV, video games, and whatever else we're given to be quiet.
Well, we may bankrupt ourselves. I mean, we may do that as an empire. So.
We're about out of time.
It's always hope.
It's always and the hope is that Tremé will get a second, a third, and fourth season.
Oh,
who
God.
Knows?
From your mouth to God's ear.
We'll see.
Yeah.
So we'll look forward to the new season of Tremé. And I want to encourage you all to hear David tomorrow night at Micah, 7 p.m. at the Brown Center, Falvey Hall, 1301 Mount Royal Avenue. And then those of you, especially down in Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Howard County, listening tonight, you can go to at 5:30 to Gildenhorn Recital Hall at the University of Maryland, 5:30 p.m. on March the 1st. All that stuff will be up on our website.
You can tell from what Mark and I just discussed, it's going to be a couple of real downers. real depressing stuff.
Lift yourself up and come here, David Simon.
Not a lot of Omar stories, just a lot of depressing stuff.
David, thanks for being here, brother. Good to
thanks
have you.
Thanks for having me.
David Simon's been in the studio this evening. On the way out the door, I need to remind you, but I have to remind you, this is very important. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Division of Transplantation, where patients' lives are enhanced by a renowned transplant program for innovation and excellence in kidney, liver, pancreas transplants. Information available, 1-800-492-5538. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our interns are Tiffany Means, Alex Pearson, and Elizabeth Walker. We're engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear other interviews we've done, find out information about the guests and their work, go to steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Stay tuned for Deborah Owens coming here to tell you how to make a wealthy lifestyle and take care.